I think that managing cricket talent is still quite nascent. The ones that we know have had brilliant cut through, people like Andrew Flintoff, have made bigger names for themselves probably off the cricket pitch than they did on it.
Hey everyone, I'm Katie Traxton and you are listening to Anatomy of an Agency, the podcast that explains to you exactly how the talent industry works. In this episode, we are joined by Kate Miller. Kate is the Chief Communications Officer at the England and Wales Cricket Board, and with over 20 years of experience in communication and brand building in sport, she is an ideal person to explain to us all the intricacies of this complicated world. I started by asking her to explain the difference between an agency, a rights holder, and a brand, and how each of those would work with sporting talent like a cricketer.
Agencies represent multiple clients and multiple brands or organisations, so they have quite competing demands, but for talent are quite good to form relationships with because it means that you can work across a whole breadth of sectors. A rights holder in our world, with the England and Wales Cricket Board, we own the rights to lots of cricket within England and Wales. So in particular, we talk about media rights, so we own the rights which we sell to Sky and to BBC. And then a brand, I mean, we're a bit confusing because we have rights that we sell, but we also have the England brands that we take care of. So England men, England women, England disability teams are all brands within our organisation as well. But the more sort of wider term, a brand might be Coca-Cola, and a more sort of commercial organisation in the sort of historical sense.
If I'm a cricketer, if I'm another athlete that thinks that I could be promoting cricket, getting it out to new audiences, whatever it may be, should I be looking to be in touch with everyone, the agencies that represent the ECB, the ECB and the sponsors, or who should be my first port of call?
That's a really good question. I mean, historically, brands will have bigger budgets than rights holders. So I think if you want to follow the money, it's good to start to forge relationships with brands that you know have close relationships with sports. So the financial sector, you know, we're here at the home of cricket at Lords. Barclays is a really big partner here now. With one of our big partners is Toyota, the big car manufacturer. So I think looking and identifying brands that closely align with sport is a really good place to start. They will historically, again, have bigger budgets than potentially a rights holder. And we often will collaborate with them on pieces of work. So Toyota is a really good example. We've actually got a workshop with them in a couple of weeks' time to think about what we're going to deliver with talent, with content, and with other campaign work later this year. So a little bit of a mix of two. But if you do want to follow the money, I would suggest going through the brand route. If you are a bit more purpose-led, perhaps you're already financially comfortable and more purpose-led work is what you're thinking about following, I would then go to rights holders and think about how you can support their aims. So ours are around inspiring a generation to say cricket's a game for them, focusing on the recreational side of things, trying to get more children to pick up a bat and a ball. If that's your bag as talent and something that you want to pursue and support, you know, go and speak to rights holders. I think there's not one size fits all answer, really.
You obviously have the cricketers who are the face of cricket, and probably some of the team at the ECB as well fulfill that remit. We'll come back to them. But first off, the people that you're alluding to now, who is it you're looking for to help you promote the sport of cricket? Is it just avid cricket fans, or is it people who are new to the sport? Who are you after?
It would be good, again, as talent to understand target audiences for organisations, for brands and for rights holders. Cricket has been trying to break out of its bubble for some time now. For those of you that are familiar, the 100 and how that competition was conceived and how we've been executing it over the last 5 years has been very much about taking cricket to new audiences. So, we want to diversify who is a fan of cricket. So we are looking for parents, for more young people, more ethnically diverse people to come in and join the sport. So if you are talent who can help us connect with those audiences, then we want to talk to you.
And what do you do if you're one of those people? Do you get in touch and say, hey, I exist? Or do you get in touch and say, hey, I've got a great idea, but then maybe that clashes because you've got people coming up with great ideas? What is the best amount of information and form in which people can share it with you?
It's a really good question. What's the best way of working with us? I think as a team, we are quite creative. I think if somebody brought an idea to us, a really good example, they're more on the influencer side of things, but there's a group called Cricket District. who obviously are very crickety, but have great reach across, you know, YouTube and Instagram and some of those channels. They often bring creative ideas to us where they want to take perhaps some of our archive or some of our old media rights and then use that to create content. And that's quite a quid pro quo arrangement with them. But, you know, if talent came to us who potentially had good reach into young female sporty audiences and they had an idea, perhaps it might be around fitness and nutrition or talking to some of our experts that work with our athletes on how they could bring content like that to life, we'd be really interested in it. We are ideas first, and we're also really busy, so if anyone can help us cut through that noise and has a great idea about how we can take cricket and follow that sort of purpose of getting into new audiences, then we definitely want to hear from you.
What about the channels through which you want to reach audiences? Is it mainly social media and social media ideas that people should be coming to you with? Or are you interested in people chatting about podcasts or, I don't know, hosting pop-up events or saying that they can get you PR traction somewhere?
I think it's a mixture of everything, a mixture of PR, a mixture of content, a mixture of kind of physical events. If we take the Women's World Cup, so England and Wales are hosting the T20 Women's World Cup next year, in 2026. You know, we're really looking there for how we can collaborate around topics that are kind of culturally relevant as well. So we're looking at ideas about how we take cricket into the fashion space. So are there collaborations that we can do with fashion brands or fashion influencers? Are there collaborations that we can do around arts or music? So music and sport often quite closely aligned. So it isn't just that sort of formal crickety sort of straight route. I think we would be open to all sorts of creative ideas and how actually we get cricket into more cultural conversations.
Coming back to the cricketers themselves, if I were a young cricketer, well, it never would have happened, but were I a young cricketer and I'm thinking about my career and I probably have a good idea of what the sporting pathways are that I want to take, I want to get into a club and then I maybe want to play for my country, etc. What else should I be keeping in mind about the world of cricket around that? Whose responsibility is it to help me, or who could I find who might help me understand how to navigate the path off the pitch?
I think that managing cricket talent is still quite nascent in terms of cricketers that are, you know, the ones that we know have had brilliant cut through, people like Andrew Flintoff, have made names, bigger names for themselves, probably off the cricket pitch than they did on it. I think there's a few key challenges for talent in this day and age. I think audiences and the wider world expect them to perform on and off the pitch. You've got to have, I think there's a view that you need to have something about you, you need to be quite purpose-led. If we look at the likes of Marcus Rashford and Harry Kane in football, you know, they are quite purpose-led individuals on and off the pitch. I think that's really helpful in creating a good brand, and that's certainly something that we would want to see in the future. Obviously, we've got players like Joe Root, who are, you know, amongst the world's best batters. But if I were stretching Joe into more things, if it was something that was of interest to him, I think he's really happy to let his cricket do the talking for him. But I think there are more things that cricket could be looking at off the pitch and what people want to stand for. We've got great players like Danny Gibson in the England women's squad, who's doing really great stuff on TikTok and building up quite a mainstream name for herself. Sarah Glenn is aligning herself with some of the bigger brands and doing work off the pitch. She's talked a lot around period poverty and the stigmatism that can exist around menstruation, and done some really nice work with the Unilever brands. It's been really good to see though that type of work coming to the fore with some of our talent.
Whose responsibility is it, or who is available to help them with that?
I think we would always want athletes to be responsible for that. You know, our job is very much about guiding and promoting and developing them as cricket players. Our remit stretches very far as it is. I think then stretching beyond what they do off pitch is a step, probably a step too far for us as a national governing body. For me, I think that needs to be driven by the athletes themselves. They need to know what they stand for, what they want to push, what their aims are, and then either get good agents and people that can support them with that work, or align themselves with brands that can help them with that too. But I think in a nutshell, for us, that would be player-led.
What about player care? We were speaking on the podcast recently with someone who looks after player care in football, which seems to be probably more needed because there's a lot of media attention there and they're exposed to a lot, but also more formed than it necessarily is in other sports. However, it's absolutely critical in order for players to be able to make the most of their skill on the pitch, in order to be able to tackle all the attention off the pitch. Is that the responsibility of a rights holder, or should that come from somewhere else?
I don't think there's a one-step solution to that. I think it's a combination of things. Like, the social media platforms have got a huge role to play in some of the abuse that we're seeing of women and people of colour at the moment. That definitely needs to be tackled by more than one people. I think the roots are probably, you know, players being aware of that, us being aware of it from a sort of psychological perspective. Like, you know, we mostly cater for the pressures of performance, but actually the pressures on an athlete now are much bigger than just, am I going to play well or not? As you've quite rightly pointed out, it comes through social media, through a media narrative. And we would cover off probably a significant proportion of that, but more through a performance lens. If it's around online safety, I think that's a combination of things like the social media platforms, player agents, and then probably some legislation and regulation that needs to come through on that particular topic as well. So it quickly, I think it's a combination of things.
Is there a big difference between the men's and the women's game in terms of the opportunities, in terms of the support, in terms of the understanding of how to develop yourself as a brand as well as a sports person?
Yeah, I mean, hugely so. I mean, some of the data around men versus women, like 8% of primetime TV is dedicated to female sport. That immediately makes the women a less valuable commercial proposition than their male counterparts. We're really hoping some of that starts to shift in the next few years. Like, we talk a lot about how women's sport celebrates moments, not a sort of long-term change in the game. Like, a lot of that's still got to shift. You know, women are perceived, not by everyone. We've got brilliant brands that we work with, like Metro Bank, who've really thrown themselves behind women's sport. But, you know, men are perceived to be a much more valuable investment proposition than women's sports stars are, and that's just not specific to cricket. I think that's across the mainstream. The Lionesses are doing brilliant work in football in helping move that forward. We know there's appetite from government, from DCMS, from Downing Street to really start to promote women's sport in the next few years, but the golf is still really significant and needs to be, like, there's a lot that needs to happen to move that forward still.
Do you think on that basis there is more slack within the industry for young women, for example, if they get in touch and they don't really know how to handle things, so maybe they're not bringing you the fully formed idea, or maybe they're not entirely sure how to represent themselves, is there that additional support, or are they just expected to be as fully formed as the guys and turning up and knowing exactly how it all works?
I think the men, and I speak purely through a cricket lens, I think the men's players are exposed to more professionalism in the men's game earlier than women are. So because our sort of pipeline of talent is not so rich and so deep in the women's game yet, we can often see a young girl go straight from school, straight into the England women's squad. That's a big leap and that's quite a lot of pressure immediately going from being a sixth former and then performing on the world's biggest stages. Even though the stage might be perceived to be smaller, you're at the top of your game, you're traveling around the world, you're on television, you're being asked questions by the media, your performance is under scrutiny, the way you look is under scrutiny. And is the support around that there yet? No, it's not. There probably is a lot more that needs to happen for women in that space. And men, it's just more of an incremental increase. They'll go from school into rookie contracts, into professional first team contracts, and then they'll start to get up to the England level. So the pipeline's just a bit, it just takes longer. I think women are projected far more rapidly into the spotlight.
We hear a lot, you can't be it if you can't see it. But then also, if that's true, certain underrepresented groups will never make it. So there need to be pioneers. If there were anyone kind of listening to this podcast who loves cricket, or maybe even wants to get into a different sport, but really feels, when I look at this sport and I listen to this sport, it doesn't sound like it's for me. All I know is that I love it. What advice would you give them on kind of getting going and trying to carve a path for themselves?
I always try and talk about, like, the whole world and the whole narrative now exists around things that are very binary, very black and white. And I think cricket is in two states. I think it is historically a sport that has underserved communities and prioritised male progress. But it's also a sport that's doing a huge amount of positive work to bring more people and more audiences in. And I would always encourage anyone to try and step away from that very black and white debate. Yes, of course, we've got things wrong historically over the years, But there are incredible programs now happening for women, for people of color. We've got great programs like the African Caribbean Engagement Program happening, which is being run out of across the country, but was originated from South London. They put out an amazing call out ahead of the LA 2028 Olympics, where cricket's reappearing after a break of about 100 years. They're looking for young black sprinters to take their skills and move them into cricket, where obviously that skill is can transfer into fast-paced bowling. So they put a call out maybe a year or 18 months ago, looking for young girls across South London and other parts of the country who are doing really great work in the sprinting space. So I think that's really interesting, and that's just one example of what cricket's doing to kind of throw its doors open a little bit more. You know, we're investing more money than ever before into some of these diversity programs. So I think what I would say is, like, give us a chance. Like, we can all read the media rhetoric. Like, I think cricket is aware of where we've gone wrong in the past, but there's a lot more accessibility. There's more girls' cricket clubs than ever before. There's more cricket clubs across the country throwing open their doors and wanting to create girls' sections. So, like, bear with us, keep working with us. We do want to bring opportunities for everybody in the sport.
I guess the flip side of that access piece, which honestly sounds great, some of those initiatives sound fantastic, is at the other end of your career, if you do get access into cricket and you make it and you have this fantastic stage and you love the sport, what happens to the players when they retire, either maybe because of their age or because of injuries? So it can be more sudden, less planned. What support is there for them at that point so they don't just kind of step off the edge of a cliff?
Yeah, I mean, we work really closely with I think we've become a lot more aware of that. We've had, you know, great case studies like Marcus Trescothick, who's talked a lot, who's a former England cricketer and now a coach in the England setup, who's sort of talked a lot about de-transitioning from cricket. You know, in cricket there's an added pressure in that they go into a sort of cricket bubble, they tour the world, they're away from their families, and they sort of, all the time that they're a professional cricketer, that's all they do, and they do it travelling, and they're on the road all the time. So I think there is a sort of acknowledgement that the pressure of transitioning from an active player into retirement is pretty hard for cricketers. We work really closely with the Players Union, the PCA, on how players can retrain towards the end of their careers. And then obviously with our England players as well, there's a lot of psychological support for them that will continue after their careers finish, if it's necessary. But again, it goes back to one of your earlier questions as well, around what can players do during their active professional career to build out a good player brand that can take them into retirement and beyond. You know, we've seen players like Alex Hartley, who began a podcast during her playing career that's now transitioned into a broadcast career. We see players taking their coaching badges and their coaching qualifications whilst they're still actively playing to take them into the coaching sphere afterwards. And many of them are, you know, as I said, are looking at being influencers and working with brands, and then others go into more sort of selection or more sort of administrative roles in cricket. So there's lots of different scope for it, but I think players now are becoming more aware of how they're going to transition from the sport and what they'll do at the end of it. Jimmy Anderson's a great example of someone who's, you know, taken a quite a sort of grumpy persona within cricket and used that to forge a really good media career. Stuart Broad's done a brilliant job in transitioning out just a couple of years ago as one of the top bowlers in the world into already a very strong broadcast career, and is being really well regarded in that space.
And again, without flogging the same point, because I'm really enjoying being on this track for some reason today, but when men come out of cricket, they've probably earned more, they've probably had higher profiles, they've probably had more sponsorship opportunities, etc., pushing their profiles out into the world. For the female players, is there an opportunity for them to get, I don't know, some kind of professional support in understanding maybe how to transition into broadcast or how to find other opportunities in the world of sport and entertainment, rather than maybe just having to step back and going, right, I'm going to start from square one again, retrain and go into another career?
I think it's hard for anyone to think about pivoting. I don't know what I would do if I was told at my age that I've got to start a new career or where I'd even begin. But as I said, you know, we fund the PCA, the Players Union, and there is a lot of support through the union to help players transition. The women's cricket is growing rapidly in terms of remuneration, and they are now some of the most highly paid team athletes in England and Wales. The global platform for women's cricket is huge. Women's IPL plays players really handsomely, as does some of the other leagues across the world. And you're right, there's still a big gulf between men's and women's players, but it now, being an England cricketer can now set you up for life financially, but of course not everyone can be at the top of their game. So I think working with the PCA, starting to ask some of those questions early in your career and thinking about what you want to do, is it something that you want to build out a brand around? So, you know, some of our female players are interested in fashion or beauty. Sarah Glenn, I've talked about, is quite well known for that. Some of them are really interested in going down the coaching route. I think having an idea about that as early as possible and starting to have those conversations before you're anywhere near retirement is a really good space to be in. Heather Knight, I know, who was our former England women's captain, undertook a master's in leadership alongside her playing work to help her transition into a role as she came out of cricket. And we've got many England players that still work within the ECB and are set up here as well. But I think having an idea about what interests you, potentially trying to study while you're playing, because there is a lot of downtime in cricket, I think are really good routes to consider as well.
We hear it time and again that transitioning out of sport is the hardest part of an athlete's career. So that was some really useful advice from Kate. That's all for today, but do get in touch, as always, via email, gvo@goodvibesonlytalent.com or on social media @goodvibesonlytalent. And other than that, bye-bye.